Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us for an hour that goes from math anxiety and an update on Lexington's Lyric Theater to the Lexington Band Archipelago, details of a tribute to Dolly Parton, and our latest radio play by David Miller of Lexington featuring Roger Leeser, Paul Thomas, and Whit Whitaker, who first joins us in his role as the person who's making things happen at Lexington's Lyric Theater. He's here in conversation with Dr. Gerald Smith, host of our series on racial justice and equality.
Mr. Whit Whitaker, a native of Detroit, Michigan, who now makes Lexington, Kentucky his home, is a graduate of the University of Kentucky, where he earned his Bachelor of Music in Vocal Performance and his Master of Arts in Art Administration. He served in the reserves at the rank of Sergeant E5 and finished his service in the rank of First Lieutenant. Whit is a performing artist who has performed in the United States and abroad. He is a local favorite on the theater stage and has performed in many productions with several performing arts organizations. He is currently the executive director of the Historic Lyric Theater and Cultural Arts Center, president of the Lexington Fayette chapter of the NAACP, co-chair for the Episcopal Diocese of Lexington, and a member of the Commission for Racial Justice and Equality. Mr. Whitaker, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
I want to begin with you providing the audience with some information on the history and mission of the Lyric Theater and Cultural Arts Center.
Well, yes, sir. The mission of the Lyric Theater and Cultural Arts Center is to preserve, promote, present, and celebrate diverse cultures with special emphasis on African-American cultural heritage. And we do that through artistic presentations of the highest quality, educational programming and outreach, film and opportunities for community inclusion. And the Lyric originally opened up in 1948 as a movie house, showed classic films and cartoons, eventually evolved into a hub for the African-American community with R&B and jazz, with such greats as Duke Ellington, B.B. King, Sarah Vaughan, Red Fox, some of Elvis Presley's crew came through. And it closed in 1963, most people say because of desegregation. I say it closed because of segregation, because you don't want to blame the victims. It closed up because of segregation to overcorrect Jim Crow laws. And it reopened in 2010 with new vitality. It opened up with a cultural center, community room, which we use for rental events. We have an art gallery, an African-American museum, and the theater, which originally was a 900-seat theater, is a 526-seat proscenium theater. And we host all type of events from weddings to musicals to plays, you name it.
Now, you noted that it closed because of segregation. As you've already indicated, it was the quote-unquote black mecca of entertainment, in not only in Lexington, but throughout the state. I mean, everyone knew about the Lyric. But do you want to speak a little bit more about that your thoughts that it closed because of segregation?
Yeah, so because of Jim Crow laws and, just the history of the country, African-Americans weren't allowed to, be patrons in white establishments. So when, the laws changed, including, influence from Dr. King and civil rights people, when the laws change that allowed African-Americans to go to white institutions, our community obviously started going down a little bit because now you have, more options. But when people say it closed because of that, I have to remind them, then you're saying it was the fault of African-Americans who are now doing what they should have been able to do in the first place. Is their fault that everything closed down when the laws were a correction of what should have been right in the first place. It wasn't because of desegregation. It was because of segregation. Desegregation was the correction of what should have been done.
Mm-hmm. So since it's reopening, what kind of response are you getting from the community?
Well, we get really great responses. There was a lot of energy, obviously, when it opened, and then being new to the community, because the community came together to keep it from being condemned, because it was going to be condemned two different times. So it was saved from that, like the phoenix, it rose from the ashes to survive today. So the community has been having a great response, being patrons of it. In past years, there have been some, you know, concerns about some of the programming, because we do have a focus on diversity. So we even though we focus on the African diaspora and the African American cultural heritage, we also want to be inclusive to allow other events. So we have folk events like Wood Songs, which is a international event that's, you know, presented all over the world on Armed Forces Radio. We've had painting and exhibits for Hispanic artists here. We've had Japanese dance. So I had an artist from China who came here and displayed his works. So the community is alive and well and is excited about, especially since I've been here since August 5th, 2019, they're excited about some of the things that I'm doing and bringing here. So.
Okay. Now, you've got a strong cultural arts background, so just kind of elaborate that on that a little bit more in terms of your vision, you know, for the theater.
Well, yeah, I luckily I started out playing violin when I was 8 years old, and right now I play in the band. I've performed in operas and plays and everything, so I take the arts, you know, really seriously, and my thing is using the arts to uplift the communities. I think artists and arts organizations should give back to the community, should use that platform to help strengthen the community. So my vision for the Lyric was to raise this national and international recognition and cultural relevance, and build on the deepening connections to artists and the citizens who live in these communities, especially the African-American community, and with the hopes of establishing the Lyric as a true African-American cultural icon and presence like in its heyday, and to serve as a beacon, you know, for cultural entertainment and for hope for the people in our community.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're also a member of the Permanent Commission for Racial Justice and Equality. How do you see the Lyric contributing to the goals and objectives of that commission?
Well, one of the things we've been doing since I've been here, we've been having more community-wide events where we can hear the community voice. We've hosted several candidate forums for the community to come out to talk to candidates. We've hosted forums on AIDS, HIV with Magic Johnson's wife. So one thing we want to do to align with the commission, we want to be an arm extension to reach out into community, to embrace the diversity, to embrace the cultural relevance, and to increase equitable situations in the arts, just as the commission is trying to do in general for the city. Because even in the arts, is, you know, or in education or anything, it's creating equity is very important so that all people have accessibility to these things.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about Lexington's race relations? And what's your perspective on it? Now, you know, you see it from different angles. You're working with the Episcopal Diocese of Lexington, which has a commission for racial reconciliation, and now this commission on racial justice and equality. And you're involved with the NAACP. So, you know, what do you think about Lexington's race relations? And also, as in your role as chair of the NAACP here, what are some of the challenges and opportunities that you see that continue to exist in Lexington?
Well, the opportunities can be many if people are open to them. It's even in the divisiveness, there's opportunity to come together to talk and to understand why people feel a certain way. A lot of the challenges is when you talk about things like, you know, Black Lives Matter, or you're talking about reparations, or getting people to not look at being woke as a bad thing, people feel like it is an attempt to silence their cultures or their beliefs, when all we're trying to do is kind of create an opportunity for openness and acceptance. And we've done this with Clark County school system. We've visited them to help with diversity issues. We've been doing it with, you know, with people here dealing with child care centers. We've been doing it just in general conversations in our meetings, meeting with political candidates and talking things over. So there, the opportunities are many as far as trying to improve race relationship. The problem is many people, whether it be Black, white, or whatever, are kind of stuck in their ways sometimes and think of progress as an offense on their character or their belief. So it's, you know, the challenge is trying to create an atmosphere where that openness for everyone, so no one feels excluded, but so no one feels like they're being attacked. So that's always a challenge.
Well, you know, definitely your work is about bringing people together, and you've got several upcoming programs. So you want to take this time to talk about some of the upcoming events at the Lyric?
Yeah, so we have the Drifters coming up here October 29th, and Drifters is a throwback to the old days. Like I said, back in the day, we had B.B. King, Cab Calloway, people like that. And actually, we had B.B. King's daughter here at the Lyric last year. We also have Kwanzaa program that we do every year. M.K. Asante, who is an educator, speaker, author, movie producer, he's going to be coming to talk about his experiences as an artist and producing. We have big plans for Juneteenth programming. We'll have a special guest speaker that I've spoken to. I think you know him very well.
Yeah.
As far as and some music that's going to be going on. We're planning some cultural events with some kids from William Morris Brown and local schools to do some programming and be involved in programming for Black History Month. So yeah, we're constantly getting different type programs in, bringing our FAM program back, which is Family Art Memories, and it's a hybrid program where we send home arts projects for the families and the kids to engage, and then we partner with Black Soil, which is a local African-American farm co-op, to provide farm fresh vegetables to focus on healthy eating and to address food nutrition issues. Mm-hmm. So a lot coming down the pipeline.
Now, to support the work of the Lyric, can people make donations?
Yes, we really encourage, because that's how nonprofits, survive, especially in this, pandemic atmosphere. People are less leery to come out and actually occupy the seats. So you can always go to our website, www.lexingtonlyric.com, and, we take donations. You can drop checks by. You can also help by purchasing tickets to events to help fill the seats. And then there are also volunteer opportunities many times. So there are several ways that the community can contribute. But donations are very much appreciated and needed.
All right. That's Whit Whitaker, Executive Director of the Lyric Theater and Cultural Arts Center. I'm Gerald Smith for Eastern Standard.
Yes. Greetings. It is I, the Count. And it's time to answer that fascinating question. What is the Sesame Street number of the day?
If you're good at math, you have my enduring respect and admiration. Math is hard enough for many of us on a good day, but math anxiety has been a thing for as long as I can remember. The vast majority of Americans report at least some levels of discomfort with math, and about a third report moderate to severe anxiety about the subject. More than 25 years of research suggests math anxiety can begin in the early elementary grades and increase through middle and high school. And of course, the pandemic and remote learning have had an impact. Well, mention of this prompted Gil Hunter, co-host of our series on education, to reach out to University of Kentucky math education professor Jonathan Thomas.
Dr. Thomas, thank you for talking with me today.
Absolutely. Glad to be here.
Well, Dr. Thomas, I have 3 English degrees. I took 1 math class in all of college, and it did not go well. I've spent years wondering what went wrong, honestly, and to put it bluntly, I didn't like the class. Dr. Thomas, you have a doctorate in math education. Clearly, you're much more comfortable with math than I am. And more than that, you've thought a great deal about why some students are like, I guess, I was. So today we're talking about math anxiety. To start, what exactly is math anxiety?
So I think we can sort of frame math anxiety, in its simplest terms, as experiencing some response in mathematical situations that's negative and it's strong enough to impede our actions and shut us down. It can be a physical response, or it can be something internal that maybe we don't see. But what I want to do is, throughout this conversation, though, is maybe disentangle anxiety from this notion of mathematical struggle. You know, sometimes anxiety can occur in situations where students, you know, excel in mathematics, but there's still some anxiety that crop up. But sometimes it can happen when we struggle mathematically. In my journey, similar to yours, I wasn't always the mathematics enthusiast that I am today. For a long time in my life, all the way through high school and through time in the Army, I struggled with mathematics, didn't understand the rules of the road, why we did what we did, or didn't see relevance to mathematics. And it was really a puzzling discipline for me for quite a long time. So I come at this through the lens of somebody who was not always viewed themselves as mathematically capable or even mathematically inclined or interested in mathematics at all. But I think that would be my short answer to sort of what we're talking about when we talk about math anxiety.
When does math anxiety show up? And what I mean by that is, like, maybe are students okay developmentally as they learn to count, as they add and subtract? But then maybe when they hit long division or algebra or something like that, they experience anxiety. Is that how you see things working? And then when you see it working, however that might be, how does it manifest itself?
I think that this idea of struggle or is one element that can prompt anxiety. And to the extent that we can target, you know, when it occurs, it can occur in a lot of different situations or contexts. I may be comfortable with mathematics for a while and then encounter something that makes me uncomfortable or anxious. And so it's hard to put sort of a timeline on when anxiety might manifest. But I think there are a few elements that are intertwined. And I think one of the first elements is maybe we encounter ideas or concepts that we kind of struggle to understand or incorporate into our worldview. And then I think the second element is that there's some feeling of expectation that I should be understanding or incorporating these ideas or concepts in a way that I'm not able to. And then maybe the last element is that there may be negative consequences for not being able to do this. And so when you layer those things on top of each other, I think that's when you sort of seed the ground for potential anxiety. And then not all students will respond, you know, with anxiety, or not, it won't prompt anxiety among students in all of those situations, but I think that's the terrain where it happens.
Okay. And so that follow-up question I had was kind of, how does it manifest itself? Another way of asking that might be, what signs should parents or teachers look for to know that there's some anxiety happening there?
I mean, I think we want to look for things that are out of the ordinary. We can look for, you know, for overt or explicit signals, you know, words like, I think about, you know, my own son, when he would have had a particularly rough day, would talk about, you know, I don't want to do this anymore. I'm really frustrated. You know, those just classic signals of students telling us that they're frustrated. I mean, that can be a good signal for anxiety or at least frustration. And I think there's a distinction between frustration and anxiety. But the more subtle cues, behavioral changes, or even just, you know, little things like body positioning, you know, withdrawing or just not being willing to engage anymore. I think the thing we're looking for sort of fundamentally is students or children or people that are close to us, when they just start to check out of a mathematical space, that might be a precursor to something deeper that's going on. And what I like to do is I want to, you know, check in with teachers and see if they're seeing what I'm seeing. I may see things at home that my teachers aren't seeing, and things might be going swimmingly in math class, and something happens when they lose that support of a math class or their peers or something along the lines that prompts some struggle that doesn't occur there, or vice versa. So trying to get a 360 view of what's going on with our students, our children in that space.
You used that word really pointedly, frustration, and kind of distinguished it from struggle. And you kind of made it sound like, anyway, that frustration is healthy and maybe even struggle is healthy, where we all kind of easily agree that anxiety may not be healthy or may be considered unhealthy. So how do parents or teachers know when students struggle or when their frustration is healthy and when it's gone too far, when it's anxiety inducing?
Well, and I think that's a really, really important point, and something that we want to be really clear about as parents, as educators, and as leaders for our young people in our lives is that, yeah, absolutely, struggle is healthy. And I think a lot of times, and myself included, I used to think of struggle as something of synonymous to anxiety-provoking activity. And I would see, you know, students or children struggle with a mathematical idea, and I would try to engineer that out. And I think a more productive avenue through mathematical learning is to sort of cast struggle as healthy, as productive, as part of this process. In fact, you know, a lot of learning involves struggle. And if we're, you know, in many cases, if we're not struggling, we're not learning deeply.
Right, right.
And so sort of turning that on its head and saying, you know, this is a healthy place to be. But to your point that at some point struggle does lead to frustration, then we want to make some adjustments. And so, you know, how I sort of draw that line is when I start to see students shutting down or disengaging from the mathematical moment. And it's a hard line to find, and it's different for every student. But the thing that I take from that is that, you know, it's not a static landscape. I may miss the mark as a teacher. I may pitch a task that's a little bit too challenging. And so what I just need to do in that moment is dial down. I may offer up some guidance or help at home for one of my kiddos, and they're just not ready yet. And so I need to take a step back. Or maybe what I'm pitching is a little too easy, and I need to dial it up. But there are moves that I can make in those moments to adjust on the fly and not just live in a static landscape. One of the things I can do is just take a break. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we just need to step away and clear our heads and come back to it at a later time when we're a little bit refreshed.
I take to heart what you described as, you know, necessary stretching. I think I'll speak generally here. Nobody likes to stretch, but we know that that's where the growth occurs. And so when we kind of give in to the stretching, when we embrace the stretching, we know we're going to be better off for it. But a lot of kids don't have that willpower to push through that struggle.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, you know, doing sustained hard thinking in mathematics, that's work. And there's a lot of effort that goes into it. And so when I was a mathematics intervention teacher, we would actually do that work in fairly short durations, you know, maybe 30 minutes, maybe 40 minutes or so. But we were working hard for a while, and we would have a lot of disequilibrium and a lot of healthy struggle. And then we would step away for a while, and then we would come back and work on it. So I think, you know, we need to build in that step away time as teachers and as parents. One, it's just healthy to sort of give our mathematical muscles a little chance to relax, and also that reflection in the off time. I can do a lot of creative and inventive thinking, even just stepping away from something. I can make some breakthroughs that I wouldn't have if I just really keep minds on in a way that that might tire or fatigue me in a certain way.
Yeah, that makes great sense, because it's not like we compartmentalize learning. We may struggle with a problem that we're mulling over that we can't solve. We go on to something else that stays kind of rooted around in our mind, and we think about it and we come back to it. I think that can be effective, but it also can be planned. I think that's part of what you're pointing to, that the teachers can plan for that kind of deliberate approach.
Absolutely. It reminds me of an example. I had a student that we were working on the problem 400 minus 198, and he was really struggling with this task. I was trying to push for him to do it mentally. And the idea was that, you know, 400 minus 198 is pretty similar to 400 minus 200. And there's a pretty efficient pathway through that task, but it was really challenging. And so I asked him, I said, just put that one to the side and let's think about 100 minus a 98. Mm-hmm. And pretty quickly, he said, oh, that's two.
Right.
And I said, okay, let's just stop there and we'll come back to that 400 sometime down the road. And I would say probably 15 minutes later or so, he's like, you know what? I think I know what's going on with that 400
exactly.
minus 98.
Uh-huh.
And it was just that time away that allowed for that breakthrough that I'm not sure we would have gotten there if I just would have hung in that space and pressed for it.
Right. I want to ask kind of about what you've seen in the classroom with teachers. I think a lot of parents are interested in, okay, I can help my kid with math. That's one-on-one work. We won't go into, you know, that math is different than the way I did it, et cetera, et cetera. But I want to ask about kind of how the most effective teachers do what you're describing when they have maybe 30, 32 students in a classroom at the same time. How do they do that?
Yeah, I think what you're highlighting is one of the toughest parts of teaching, and differentiating our instruction across a group of students is really, really hard work. But it really starts with the design. And so when we think about our lessons and the experiences that we're going to plan out for students, we want tasks that have multiple entry points and ways that students can find their way into a mathematical experience at different conceptual levels. And then when we get into that implementation space, we want to be watching closely. We want to be attending to students' words, their activity, their finger movements, catching as much detail as we can, interpreting that movement, and then making decisions. What we want to keep in mind is that this is hard-won expertise, and these are the types of things that we do in teacher preparation programs day in and day out, and we train to do this sort of differentiation and meeting students. But it's hard work, and folks that you'll find in the classroom doing it have gone through a lot of growth to get to where they are.
Yeah, you've given me yet another example of how teachers are superheroes, and I appreciate
indeed.
That. I've just got a couple minutes left with you, and I wanted to ask this question. I'm just going to be putting it really bluntly here. I hear from people all the time, especially math teachers like yourself, that we use math every day. So we're just talking, you and me, you can tell the truth. Most of us don't really need math, do we?
Yeah. I mean, I think there was a period of time where I felt that way. And I know that there are a lot of people out and about that could relate to that statement. I think it's all sort of how you look at it. We can be math avoidant if we so choose, but to me, that's a really limited world. Most every job intersects with mathematics to some extent. But I think even bigger than that is that it gives us a lens to view the world. For example, you know, having an understanding of big numbers, millions, billions, trillions, helps me interpret the news I might be receiving. Maybe going a little deeper into that, just thinking about how I experience things that are beautiful or pleasurable in some way, knowing something about complex shapes and figures and angles gives me a new layer to appreciate art and architecture. Like think about like Da Vinci's Last Supper. If I know something about symmetry, I can appreciate how Jesus and John the Apostle are sort of sitting opposite each other in that grouping, in that table. I can sort of appreciate what Da Vinci was going for in a different way, or maybe how M.C. Escher gives us a lens into like tessellations. There's just a different level of experience I can have an appreciation if I have some sort of mathematical understanding. And I think, you know, that's the real key. You know, mathematics is all around us, but it can remain hidden if we don't look for it. And that's part of our job as adults and teachers, is to help young people and our peers to find and explore that mathematics that's really a deep part of our world, but just stays hidden.
Hmm. Gosh, that's a terrific way of capturing that and connecting math to more than just a classroom discipline that I think so many people dread or even are anxious about. And I think you've done a great job of kind of giving that a different context, and I really appreciate it. Dr. Jonathan Thomas is a math education professor. He's chair of the STEM Education Department at the University of Kentucky. My name is Gil Hunter. I am the interim dean of the College of Education and Applied Human Sciences, and we've been talking today for WEKU's Eastern Standard.
Thank you so much. Appreciate the conversation.
Math anxiety doesn't just make students choke on tests. It changes their approach to learning the subject in ways that sets them up for ongoing failure. A new study in the Journal of Experimental Psychology suggests math-anxious students choose less effective ways to study, like rereading textbooks instead of working through real problems. This, in turn, can make them less prepared for exams and heighten the risk that students will also freeze on the math test itself. Researchers found math-anxious students dedicated more time to passive activities like reading their textbooks or looking at already solved problems, which prior research has found tends to make students think they understand more than they really do about the content. By contrast, they spent less time actually practicing math skills. The research findings suggest that focusing on explicit study and anti-anxiety strategies may be critical for educators working to catch up students who lost significant ground in math during the disruptions of the last 2 years. General anxiety has increased for students during the pandemic, and it's reasonable to expect increased levels of anxiety around math, especially if students are getting signals that they're not where they should be or that they're behind, according to a co-author of the study. What does a county clerk do? That job description is the latest in our weekly series in partnership with CivicLex and its director, Richard Young, describing the duties of the local offices that will appear on the November 8th ballot.
The county clerk is elected every 4 years and is in charge of many important documents, records, and processes at the county level. In Lexington, unlike our council and mayor, the county clerk is a partisan position. The office of county clerk was first mentioned in the Kentucky's Constitution of 1850. Kentucky's current constitution requires the election of a county clerk in each county for a term of 4 years. Prior to the unified state court system, the county clerk served as the clerk of the juvenile county and quarterly courts. Now, the clerk no longer has judicial duties, so the name has been shortened to county clerk. The duties of the county clerk fall into the general categories of clerical duties of the fiscal court, issuing and registering, recording, and keeping various legal records, maintaining voter rolls, and conducting election and tax duties. In Lexington Fayette County, the county clerk is responsible for a wide variety of services. They issue driver's licenses and register vehicles like cars and boats. They register voters and oversee the city's election processes, including overseeing the county's Board of Elections, which appoints election officers, secures and inspects voting locations and ballots, and establishes voting precincts. The Board of Elections and the county clerk also certify the election results. The Fayette County Clerk approves marriage licenses and notaries, and the office holds records dating back to 1792, including mortgages, deeds, wills, marriage licenses, liens, and lien releases. Many of the county clerk's records are still on paper and in books, and they are working to digitize them. Recently, the Fayette County Clerk's office announced a project to digitize the paper records regarding the sale of enslaved people in Lexington and make them searchable. In the upcoming general election, incumbent Don Blevins Jr. is running for a second term against Republican candidate Briston Quinn. Want to learn more about the positions on the ballot in Fayette County? Head on over to our elections website at lex.vote. You want to learn more about all things local government? You can check out our website at civiclex.org, subscribe to our CivicLex weekly newsletter, and follow us on social media.
For information about other local offices appearing on the November 8th ballot, visit the Civic Shorts tab on our website, esweku.org. Coming up after the break, local music and our latest radio play. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Major support for WEKU comes from Kentucky's Touchstone Energy Cooperatives, supplying reliable power and energy usage information to co-op members. Co-ops offer an online energy assessment to help evaluate energy usage. More information at your local co-op's virtual energy assessment link. WEKU is supported by Hicks and Funson, Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Mitch Whitaker provide legal representation for car and truck accidents and other personal injury matters. More information at 859-777-7000. And now, back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
Driven to insanity, driven to the edge, driven to the point of almost no return.
For year six of presenting local musicians performing the music of world-renowned artists such as Bob Dylan, Leonard Cohen, John Lennon, Joni Mitchell, and Stevie Wonder, Dolly Parton is the focus of this year's Music Permission Concert on Friday, November 4th at First Presbyterian Church in Lexington. The series is presented in partnership with Anita Courtney's Purple Carrot Productions, and overseeing things is Marlon Hurst, Director of Music and Arts at First Presbyterian. Welcome, Marlon.
Thank you.
So how did you all arrive at Dolly Parton for this year's tribute?
We keep a running list of artists that we would like to pay tribute to, and the artists that you just listed, most of them are men, and we had paid tribute to Joni Mitchell, so we were really looking for a woman this year, and Dolly has sort of had her moment, not that she ever went away, but with her podcast and with, I don't know, she seems to have been in the media attention a lot, and she's just such a great songwriter and a great person and personality that we thought this was the year for Dolly.
And so who will we hear this year? Who will be performing?
We've cultivated some acts and some participants over these first few tributes that we've done, and we have some folks who are coming back to perform for us again. We have a group called Neveim, which is Marilyn Roby and Benjamin and Margie Karp and others who are a part of that group. They've been a part of each tribute concert, so they'll be with us. A group called One Lane Bridge, which is Tatiana McGee and Mike Menkel. And then we have some new folks who have not performed with us before. Alicia McCorvey will be performing I Will Always Love You with Raleigh Daly. And Ron Penn, who's the former chair of the John Jacob Niles Center at the University of Kentucky, is going to be our MC, and he will be performing with the Rock House Old Time String Band that gathers each Monday at Rock House Brewing in Lexington. So it's a good combination of folks we've heard from before, and there are others as well, but these are just some highlights.
Really interesting to hear these artists from different genres taking on a particular genre of music and kind of making it their own.
I think so, but you know, Dolly Parton, while she has, you know, her roots are in bluegrass and country music, she of course was recently inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame,
right.
And I think she has a broad appeal, which was another reason that we wanted to pay tribute to her, because her music is so, I think, so accessible across a variety of genres.
So is it a ticketed event, and can tickets be purchased online in advance?
It is a ticketed event. It's free to the public, but this has quote-unquote sold out every year, this particular, the tribute concert has. It's at First Presbyterian Church in Lexington, and we have capacity to seat about 400 people. So tickets are available on Eventbrite, and you can go to the First Presbyterian Church of Lexington website and look for Music for Mission and link to it that way as well.
All right, this is Marlon Hurst, Director of Music and Arts at First Presbyterian Church on Market Street in Lexington, co-producer with Anita Courtney's Purple Carrot Productions of the Music for Mission Concert Series. Thanks, Marlon.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Jolene, 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 I'm begging of you, please don't take my man.
When we hear that somebody in the area is releasing a new album, it's almost always a collection of songs with lyrics and vocals. All instrumental albums are pretty rare, but a group of well-known Lexington musicians has stepped into that space with a series titled Songs from Quarantine. We previewed previous volumes released earlier in the pandemic. Now, one of those artists, Kevin Holm Hudson, is back to tell us about Volume 3. Welcome back to Eastern Standard, Kevin.
Thanks, Tom. It's good to be back.
And first, tell us again, who is on this album?
It's three local academics who are also musicians and passionate about music in general. Besides myself, there's Scott Whitten, who is professor and director of the Writing Center at Transylvania University. He plays in a local band called Letters of Acceptance. And the third member of the band is Jim Gleason, a longtime local musician, probably best known for his work with the Johnson Brothers. He recently retired from EKU.
And your academic credentials, if you would, Kevin?
I teach at the University of Kentucky, and I'm professor of music theory there.
What motivated you, Jim, and Scott to go down this path? Why instrumentals?
Well, I think all of us experienced that the pandemic was something where we had no words for what we were experiencing at that moment. In fact, I think Scott had mentioned that. I think it was actually Scott's idea that he just said, we should do some kind of ambient instrumental album. And this was early on in the pandemic when we were all in lockdown and trying to do things remotely. And so that actually led to the way that the songs, starting with Volume 1, were put together. Somebody would come up with just a short idea, maybe even just a couple of chords, and would send it out to the other two. And the rule was that there were no limitations on what could be done with this. And so it was really wonderful to send in a short idea and have the other two work on it. And then it comes back in an idea that you couldn't anticipate at all. It's kind of like, I don't know, those Iron Chef or, you know, those cooking shows where you're given three ingredients and told to make something.
You know, something you just said really strikes a chord with me, no pun intended, but that we just were at a loss for words back in those days.
I think so. I think for all of us, it was almost like a kind of sonic journaling. Volume 3 is probably the most eclectic in terms of styles that we've done. It's also got some of the darkest stuff we've ever done and just some deeply unsettling things. And I think part of it is because as we're supposedly coming out of this pandemic, there's all this uncertainty. You know, are we really past it? What's around the bend? What if there's another variant? What boosters do we need to take now to catch up with this other variant? And then, of course, there's the conflicting information that you get. So there's a lot of uncertainty, and that manifests itself, especially in Volume 3.
Well, we have a sampling from Songs from Quarantine, Volume 3. The song is Calendar. And what can you tell us about it?
Well, this is one of a couple of tracks on Volume 3 that have the participation of guest musicians. On this particular recording, we have David Chapman, who plays drums in my band, Dr. Kevin Holm Hudson and the Adjuncts. And so it was one of those situations where we sent our mix on to him, and he determined the tempo and put on the drum track in his studio and sent the drum track back to us. I mean, we all continue to work remotely with this, even if maybe the restrictions are relaxed and we could get together, but it does put a kind of distancing perspective into it that is actually pretty attractive. So it's David Chapman on drums.
Okay, let's give it a listen. That's a passage from Calendar. It's a track on the new Archipelago album, Songs from Quarantine Volume 3. And we're talking with Kevin Holm Hudson, who's a member of the group. How can we find it?
The web address is Archipelago Songs. It's all one word, archipelagosongs.bandcamp.com. And I should mention, because I don't think we've mentioned it yet, all three of the volumes have been a benefit of recording for the Central Music Academy, located in Lexington. Central Music Academy gives free musical training to kids in all areas of musical performance and expertise since 2004. They've given over 45,000 free lessons to more than 1,500 students. And we really believe in what they do and have been doing. And a lot of art organizations were hit kind of hard by the pandemic. So we wanted to continue our support of Central Music Academy. So what I'm getting at here with Bandcamp is that you pay what you want, and all of the proceeds from that go to Central Music Academy.
Well, that is just wonderful, and it kind of keeps things moving forward, doesn't it?
That's the plan.
All right. Kevin Holm Hudson, keyboardist with the Lexington instrumental band Archipelago. Thank you so much, Kevin.
Thank you for having me.
From time to time, we like to work with playwrights, actors, and directors in our listening area to create some Theater of the Mind radio. For Eastern Standard, that takes the shape and form of a series of radio plays. Our latest, Three's a Charm, written by David Miller of Lexington, and featuring Paul Thomas as Joe, Whit Whitaker as Billy, and Roger Leeser as Al.
Horse looks good, don't he, Billy? Three's a Charm. What a name. I got a feeling this is his day. You look smooth as baby feet working him out.
Yeah, he looks good.
I've been training horses since before you were born, and I ain't never seen a better one. So this is it for me, Billy. I'm going to take up what little dough I got and pretend I never heard of a racetrack. I got my eyes on a little place. Well, nothing fancy. Maybe keep a horse or two. Maybe now and then go to a sit-down race. Why, some of those trotters can really... What's wrong, Billy?
Nothing wrong.
Oh, now, we've known each other a long time, Billy. Today is just your day, too. You ought to be excited. Me, I'm on my way out. You still got a lot of rides in you. You're going to... Oh, come on, what is it, Billy?
I'm fine, Joe. It just got a lot on my mind.
Won't be long now. Now that I will miss. The yelling and cheering and the people dressed up like it was Sunday school in Paris. Or the old-timers, long shooters. Some of those guys have suits older than you are. I remember, but...
Hey there, Billy. Joe?
Oh. I mean, Mr. Keener. What are you doing here?
Oh, can a guy keep eyes on his investment? Have a seat, Joe.
I don't want no seat. This ain't your horse. You got no claim on this horse.
I'm not talking about a horse.
You're not supposed to be here, Mr. Keener.
What are you talking about? Why you come in here?
He's here to see me, Joe.
That's right, Joe.
Billy, you don't want to get mixed up with this guy. You even seen with him. It's your last ride.
Shut up, Joe. It's my last ride anyway. I played it straight my whole career and got nothing but a mouthful of dirt. You get three or four animals boxing you out, ain't your fault you finish out of the money. Now I'm just going to do what everybody else is doing. I finally got a horse that can't be boxed out. Don't never flag. Don't need a whipping. This horse can't lose. Ain't that right, Al?
That's right, Billy. There's a lot of money out front that agrees with you.
But you know what, Joe? He can lose. He sure can. And he will lose.
What are you talking about, Billy? He's the best horse I ever laid a brush to. Didn't you see
him? You don't get it, Joe. I got a paycheck coming, and it ain't coming out of the purse. You got it?
Got what?
Sure do, Billy. Here's half. You know where the other half is. You can let your saddle get as dusty as you want after today.
You can't.
Sure I can. I already have, Joe. The other half of the money is out on that little stallion they just brought up from Tallahassee. Right, Mr. Keener? Today ain't this horse's lucky day. He ain't charmed.
That's right, Billy. The money's out on that little 15-to-1 horse from Florida. And he's gonna win.
What do you mean?
Come on, Joe. You know how this works. With this money, I can set myself up on a little farm somewhere. Ride when I want to ride. I won't have to scrape and bow, and I won't have to keep my mouth shut when I'm seeing something wrong. I won't have to take orders from from rich people.
You think you swallowed a lot of track dirt, Billy? Ta! I've been around, too. I kept my head down so long my shoes are lined with scratch tickets. Now it's my turn. This here horse is my lucky charm. A rabbit's foot in a four-leaf clover. Bad money's been out on me. That stops today.
It's almost time. I can't let you do this, Billy. If they find out, you'll never... I mean, what am I supposed to do?
Same thing you've been doing. Look the other way. Train the best horses you can to finish out of the money every time.
You can't do this, Billy. Billy, please don't. I put everything I had on this horse.
You what? You bet today, Joe?
Everything I have. Everything's on this horse. Everything I could borrow. I need the money, Billy. I got bills. My wife is sick. I've been bankrupt twice in my life. Three's a charm, right? It's this or a tall bridge.
Nothing I could do, Joe. You should have known better. I won't be seeing you no more. Goodbye.
No. They'll kill you if something goes wrong. Billy, sure as day they will.
I'm not afraid of them. This is my race. My race to lose. It's time.
I got to tell, Billy. I got to tell. I got to tell for your own good. People trust you. You've always been an honest man. You don't want to be mixed up with the
likes of... If Billy wants to be put out to pasture, old-timer, you got no cause to stand in his way. Stand down, Joe. Not my problem you put your own skin in the game. Guess what? The only reason I'm here is because somebody put a lot of money on Three's a Charm today. That somebody is you. Messed up the odds real good. You're the one that killed Billy's chances.
I can't let this happen. I gotta tell it. You wouldn't shoot me. Not here.
Oh, this thing ain't loud. It's got a baby bib on. Just stay right there and you won't have to find out. You're not going nowhere and you ain't telling no one. Race will be over in a matter of minutes and Billy and me will be long gone. Right, Billy?
Let's get one thing straight, Mr. Keener. Al, you and me won't be seeing each other after I get paid. There ain't no we.
Billy, I'm begging you. There's still time to make this right.
Get out there, Billy. Joe, get out of the way. I mean it.
Let go of me, Joe.
Let him out, Joe. If he ain't on the track in 5 minutes, he'll get scratched. And that ain't gonna happen.
I ain't letting you do this, Keener. Billy's a good man. I'm sick of monsters like you.
Get away from there, Joe.
Get back or I'll...
Stop. Joe, you okay?
I'm all right. I'm all right. Billy, I killed him.
He killed himself. His finger's still on the trigger.
His friends won't care either way, long as they get their money.
And I'm a dead man either way.
What do we do now, Billy?
That's a lot of money on that table, Joe. Take it.
I can't do that.
Take it!
I can't.
You can take it, or Al's men will, and they'll still come after me. Go, now!
Okay, but what are you gonna do, Billy?
I'm going for a ride. And I'm gonna win. Three's a charm. Right, Joe?
Don't leave me, Billy. What am I gonna do, Billy? 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 Billy!
Three's a Charm by David Miller, starring Paul Thomas as Joe, Whit Whitaker as Billy, and Roger Leeser in the role of Al. Three's a Charm and earlier Eastern Standard Radio plays are available for listening on demand on our website, esweku.org. Just click on Radio Plays. You can also check out our series on theater production in Kentucky, hosted by Bill McCann. Just click on the Series tab. Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, producing engineer and audio editor, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. Thanks to Madeline Peru, Archipelago, and Dolly Parton for their music in this edition. We're online at esweku.org, where you can check out the Eastern Standard archive, our series, our partners, and more. And you can sign up for our weekly e-newsletter featuring a preview of the next edition. You can find us on the WEKU app, on NPR One, and on the Google News app. Want to call something to our attention or suggest a topic? You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.